I think it all starts even before you get out on the court. You know, what you do to get yourself mentally prepared for the match, for you know, to get yourself in the right state of mind where you are calm, composed, serene enough, but yet you have the right intensity and the drive and motivation to play well and be dynamic and fast on the courts. Well, I can only speak on my own behalf. Obviously, we spoke about visualization and preparing yourself for possible scenarios, and I obviously try to play the match in my mind before I go on the court. You know, always try to imagine myself as a winner. I think there is a power to that, but also there has to be, next to the willpower, strength that comes not just from your physical self, but from your mental and emotional self. And it's I think it's, for me at least, it's a constant battle within, you know, more than what happens outside. It's really not the situations that you experience that are affecting you, but how you internally experience those situations, how you accept them, how you live through them. So, you know, I just told myself before the match, I'm gonna try to switch off as much as I can from what is happening around us and just be there, be present. And not a specific formula to find the courage. I mean, at least from my perspective, you can go all out and just close your eyes and just hit the ball as hard as you can, and then you can call that courage. But I wouldn't necessarily call it courage in some particular situation. So you need to be constantly playing well throughout 5 hours if you want to win the match like this. So I guess there is an endurance part, but you know, I think there's always this self-belief, and you have to keep reminding yourself that you are there for a reason and that you are better than the other guy. And as hard as the moment is that you are in, the more you have to remind yourself, the more you have to talk to yourself. I mean, that's at least in my case.
I wanted to talk to you about clutch moments. When you're in those situations, how do you avoid distractions?
Consciously breathing first. So that's probably the simplest thing that you could do, but probably the most effective. I think the experience of being in this particular situation so many times before in my career helps me every next time that I have to face the adversity and face the distractions and, you know, my thoughts and what ifs and fears and so forth. I think everyone goes through that thought process. And I don't think it's particularly bad. I was thinking it's bad, so I was trying to ignore it, or I was trying to shut it down. But I think the major transformation in a positive way for me started when I was starting to acknowledge it and accept it as part of me. It's there. My ego is there. My fears are there. Everything is there. It's present. But then how will I address it in a way that is going to help me to overcome that, to transform it into positive fuel that is going to help me overcome the clutch moments that you talked about, just feel happy and joyful and present on the court, and get the best out of that experience. I practice a lot of mindfulness, you know, meditation, journaling, talking with my team, with my parents, with my wife, with everybody who is around me, with my, of course, life coaches that I have, spiritual guides and that I have as well, that help me address certain emotional issues or traumas or whatever it is that tend to appear on the court. So when it appears on a break point, when I'm facing a match point or break point or clutch moments, they do tend to surface, but I manage to gain the control over them much quicker, and I manage to impose my positive affirmation and positive feeling. Or if that doesn't happen, then I just try to be conscious that I have to accept that moment, that that's going to happen, but I focus on my breathing and I focus on being in a moment and what needs to be done next moment, which is playing the right shot, positioning myself well on the court, and just focusing on executing the point right. It just takes years of devoted practice mentally, not just physically. And you have to do it. You can't expect others to really fix your emotional or mental issues. They can encourage you, and they can empower you, and they can understand you, and they can give you tools, but you have to use those tools and do it the right way. When you're facing adversity and when you're challenged, you should always look inside, because that's where the answer lies. I did not understand that fully. I heard that before, but I think when I went through this journey, I understood really what that means. And now I know where I can always find strength and belief and motivation to get me going.
everybody. This is Anthony. Thank you for downloading this episode of Life and Life Only. This is just a very quick introduction to say that, as you will have seen by the title, the talk I recorded with my guest has been split into three parts. I decided that the talk we did, which was about 3 hours 10 before editing, should be split into three episodes of manageable length. Now, the series I put out at the end of last year about happiness, life and death, and Derren Brown was also three parts, but much longer. But I think if I'd put that into manageable lengths, that would have been 5 or 6 parts. But anyway, I've inserted a marker to tell you when the end of part one and the beginning of part two, etc., is. It actually comes from a Beatles film, funnily enough. The clip you heard at the top there was a little compilation of Novak Djokovic, who is my favourite tennis player, talking about some of the things that make him my favourite tennis player, namely the mental strength and his appreciation of the importance of psychology and, well, the inner game, to preempt the conversation you're about to listen to. I think I'd say during the conversation I do channel him when I'm playing table tennis. I picked this video at random, not knowing that Novak was going to mention life coaching and mindfulness, which is basically meditation. I did know that he meditated. I also just want to say that I do make references back to previous episodes of Life and Life Only, which related to meditation. And there was one about tennis media and fame, and there was one about table tennis and nerves. And those are episodes 4 and 5, the two-parter of meditation. Episode 18 was the tragicomedy about table tennis. And then episode 40 was tennis, media and fame. As a heads up, you might want to revisit some or all of those episodes as a forerunner to this one, but of course you don't need to do that. This conversation can stand alone. As you'll see from the title, I've called this Life Coaching and the Inner Game. You don't have to be a tennis fan to appreciate this, but although we do talk sometimes about tennis and mention players and a few technical points, the inner game side, as you will hear, does relate to tennis in terms of the book that we talk about. And if you are a tennis fan, you'll get probably a special appreciation of this episode and the ones that are coming, this conversation. We do discuss the state of the professional game near the end of the conversation, but that'll be episode 46. If you'd like to help out the show and my podcast work in general, if you're new to Life and Life Only, I have two other podcasts, Glass Onion on John Lennon and Film Gold. There are a couple of links, PayPal and Buy Me a Coffee. Any donations are gratefully accepted, but otherwise, if you just share links and tell people about the show. So, not much more to say. We'll cut now to me about a week ago introducing this conversation and my guest. So, let's go with that. Enjoy. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 44 of Life and Life Only. And I'm very happy to have with me today Daryl Swan. We will tell you in a minute how Daryl and I knew each other, but Daryl, this is your podcast debut, isn't it? How are you feeling?
First time, yes. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. You're a very loyal listener, so you deserve to be on here. What we're going to be looking at today, we are going to be talking about life coaching. If you haven't heard episode 19, that might be a good one to listen to first. We're then going to be talking about a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. But the book is not only about tennis, it uses the context of tennis. So they're going to be talking about psychology, which is obviously a big part of Life and Life Only, sports psychology. But then, because Daryl and I are both big tennis fans, and he's a tennis player and I'm a table tennis player, we're going to be talking about the tennis scene itself in terms of Grand Slams and a little bit about that and about how, I guess we're going to be gushing a little bit about how the top guys and girls keep going for so long at this incredible level that tennis is played at these days. But there was an episode on that topic, episode 40, fairly recently, where I looked at, I think it was tennis, media and fame. Anyway, Daryl, so can you give us a quick introduction and maybe you could segue and tell us how we know each other. Tell the audience how we know each other, sorry.
Sure, you bet. So yes, my name is Daryl. I live in Canada. I am in my mid-40s, have a wife and 3 kids that are approaching young adulthood of their own. So, you know, into a middle stage of my life, if you will. But I found myself through the pandemic learning new ideas and dabbling into what you would call the outer truth and the alternative media. Doing so, you know, led me down a number of paths, some with the help of friends and acquaintances that I have, and, you know, others on my own research and readings, etc. So it led me to a little bit of a dire feeling, in a way, that, you know, I think this is almost by design, by some of the, what I'm using, air quotes, conspiracy theories, that I felt a little bit out of control. If the world is not as it seemed to be, how do I make my own place within that? And how do I reconcile, I guess, what I thought I knew versus what I'm learning and what actually is truth anyways? So this led me, well, a number of different places, but I did start feeling feelings that I hadn't felt before and being trapped and not being able to make sense of it. So I came across, Anthony, your podcast, first through your Glass Onion podcast, via a recording you did with James Corbett quite a while ago, as it related to John Lennon, and I can't remember the name of the episode.
I probably can't remember it either, so maybe the US versus John Lennon, I think it was that one.
Something like that.
Yeah, maybe. Anyway.
Well done, as all your stuff is. But it led me to you and the rest of your catalog, which, you know, includes Life and Life Only. And I found it spoke to me. And, you know, I've struggled, I guess, with various forms of motivation, lack of motivation through my corporate life and my family life, I guess, to some extent as well. But, you know, when you started talking in your Life and Life Only podcast about life coaching, it got me thinking, why not? What do I have to lose? And Anthony's a stranger from around the world, you know. what could it hurt, right? So yeah. I reached out. We started some sessions, 10 sessions, as I recall, which took about 4 or 5 months. We think we did it bi-weekly. And originally, you know, as you do, you asked your student, me, to create some goals. And so the goals or the accomplishments I wanted to get out of life coaching was, first and foremost, to help me deal with procrastination in my life, which is, I think, a common problem. And then second, with this alternative truth, outer truth strand, how do you make sense of the amount of information out there? How do you continue to live, I suppose, if you, you know, your day-to-day life, if you are starting to learn about other alternative truths, and how do you make sense of truth and honesty? In any case. So those were kind of the things we talked about, and then it flowed from there, kind of thing. Interestingly, there was through this time and through our 3 or 4 months that we were meeting in the 10 sessions that we had arranged, you know, I had an incident, as I call it, with my family. Me and my brother and our families had a little bit of a fairly big misunderstanding, which, having Anthony in my life and on the payroll, so to speak, at the time, allowed me to talk through this incident, and understand my place in it in a really non-judgmental, external kind of way. You know, if I didn't have that as a resource, I really think I would have handled it poorly. and not to say that it was perfect, but it is behind us now, and me and my brother have both moved on and, you know, face new challenges together, I guess, in our relationship as a part of that, but it's largely positive. And honestly, I attribute a lot of that to having the ability to talk through the issue, the incident, with you, Anthony. And it was a really good growth experience for me, the whole entire thing, not just because of the incident.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions in a minute about it. So today we're working through this document. We have this document that we've both been contributing to. We're going to basically just bosh through it. We've got so much to talk about. It's crazy. We might be here for the rest of our lives, but we'll see. But I think you actually wrote the definition that came up in the previous episode, episode 19. So life coaching is an ongoing conversation between coach and client, leading the client towards a more purposeful life. Clients must be inspired to make the change, guided by questions. So typically you use open-ended questions, which means questions which can't be answered with just yes or no. Use this dialogue to move towards goals and various
definitions that say consultant, motivational speaker, therapist, rent-a-friend, cheerleader. I don't like rent-a-friend because it sounds a bit, it sounds really patronizing. I just included it because it was something I found, you know. But that sounds a bit patronizing towards the coachee, particularly if they're not, you're not a kid, you know, you're. But.
Listen, though, I get it. And you had your prompt on here as what is Daryl's definition of life coaching? Mm. And that's what I thought of immediately is this list that you provided in this episode. And the rent-a-friend to me is, I understand what you're saying. It sounds patronizing, but, you know, in that moment when I needed a friend, an impartial friend, and I say this, I don't mean it to be patronizing to you either, as I paid for your services, right? But the rent-a-friend, it helped. That it's not that you were there telling me what I wanted to hear, but you were squarely on my side, if you will. You were looking out for my well-being through the incident, right? If it wasn't for the incident, I wouldn't have needed a rent-a-friend, right? I would have gone through my list of things I needed. But in that moment, having a rent-a-friend was extremely helpful. I didn't feel bad writing you a 3-page email explaining the situation because you're kind of on the payroll, you know?
I think the fact that you'd listened, I don't know how many episodes I had out then, probably 25, something like that. The fact that you'd heard them all, and I say this as a massive podcast consumer, you do feel like you know the person to some extent. You've heard their voice for so many hours, particularly if you're listening to the John Lennon one. I mean, that's just hours and hours. And what either a life coach or a therapist, and I don't claim to be a therapist, but life coaching is obviously in the same ballpark. It's in a similar ballpark, let's say. What you can offer is this third party. And I was blunt with you. Obviously, I was, like you said, there was a kind of duty of care, if you like. I didn't want to push a load of buttons that's going to make you feel bad about things. But at the same time, we managed to establish fairly quickly an openness. And the fact that there was a distance, you know, that we obviously haven't met physically. I'm very up for us meeting in the future physically. But because we're behind a computer, that is, I don't know, comforting in a way. Like you don't have to feel too exposed. So, that was great. What else have we got here? So as a person, let's say there's a person who wants to do some life coaching. I know it depends on the person, but how would you approach it? Or how would you approach anything where you're trying to improve? What do you just, is it a totally open mindset? Do you have limits? What would you say?
I mean, there has to be a need, right? Mm. And I remember the first time we chatted and you asked me, well, what do you want out of this? You know, write down 2 or 3 goals. I took that as a daunting task. I'm not a fan of goal setting. It doesn't speak to me. I'm a rather go with the flow kind of person. Mm. And, you know, that has its challenges. Being that way is part of, I guess, what we chatted about to some degree. It leads to the procrastination, right? But also in your definition, the person needs to want to change, needs to have a need to change, which implies that there's, you know, outcomes that they are not receiving. I'm being careful not to judge because we're going to talk about it in the inner game, but that there's outcomes they're looking for that they're having a hard time achieving, right? Mm. And so then on top of that, I think the person is very important as well to pick the right life coach that there's a rapport with, an understanding with, a perspective that's needed as well. And you make the good point that I had listened to a lot of the Life and Life Only catalog and some of the John Lennon Glass Onion catalog. So I did feel like I knew you. Mm. I did feel like you've got something to offer me. It must always feel like a different from your perspective when coachees reach out because you won't know them and you have to spend the time getting to know them where they might feel like you do. They do.
Yeah, well, I think one of the skills I have managed to develop through, I mean, being an English teacher for 20 years as well, is I found a way of gaining rapport fairly quickly, but without doing it in a kind of fake way. So obviously, if I'm teaching someone English or a class English, there's certain games you can do. And they are sort of contrived in a way, in a way that, I don't know, people in a classroom would play, do an activity together, it bonds them. But obviously, I'm not going to be doing that with someone who's doing life coaching because it's not a language learning. But I don't know. I suppose I've just developed a way of speaking honestly, but not seeming to try too hard. to gain rapport. I found a way of being natural, but also carrying out what I consider would be my duty, because I think there is a duty aspect to it. But in a funny way, let me draw a parallel between, let's say, even this podcast we're doing now. I said to you before we started, I'm going to edit this, so just say more rather than saying less. Don't hold back if you don't want to. And it's the same with creative pursuits. A lot of writers will tell you that one of the ways to write something, let's say you're writing a novel, is just to write and not to judge. And then you work it out later. There's this funny thing that John Cleese said. John Cleese, you may know from Monty Python or Fawlty Towers. He did this brilliant talk on creativity. And he said, you have to be a child when you're coming up with the ideas. And he means child in the sense that a child is liberated. And then your adult sorts it all out later into the good ideas and the bad ideas. So I suppose life coaching or therapy, whatever it is, you have to try and instill in the coachee the confidence just to go for it. But really, judgment, that's the nice link between this and the book we're going to be talking about, is lack of judgment. And it's very difficult. And in one of my favorite films, Apocalypse Now, my favorite actor, Marlon Brando, he gives a speech. I'm not sure if it was actually in the final film. I think it was. And he says the line, it's judgment that defeats us. And in this world of social media, man, that just seems perfect. That just seems more and more prescient, because we're always judging each other if you spend too long on social media. So what about results? I mean, were you looking for tangible results, or were you looking for just a feeling? Were you looking for a change in the sense of a change that, of the way you felt, or were you looking for some kind of concrete result? What'd you say about that?
Because I had a hard time, I guess, you know, quantifying goals and making them smart goals, specific, measurable, et cetera, et cetera. That's not my inclination to be that way. And it's part of, let's say, part of the problem with the procrastination. So is my procrastination solved, you know, since this? No, of course not. I still struggle with it. It's immensely better because of it. Actually, even me and one of my 19-year-old daughter have, you know, good conversations about procrastination, because we both struggle with it. I mean, and I think everybody does to some degree, but her and I have some good open conversations about it. And some of the, you know, the talking points or the strategies and the tactics that you helped me employ, helped me communicate those to her, which, you know, formed a bond. And I see it in her at the best of times anyways, that, you know, that she's using the strategies as well. It's something I think I'll always have as a weakness, I suppose. So it's not, so when you say, did I get anything concrete from it? You know, absolutely I did, but it's not something I can just check a box and say, that's taken care of now, right? When the alternative truth side of things, or the outer truth side of things, you know, I have gained a big perspective on that. I think the path that I was heading down was, you know, had blinders on and being led, you know, by well-intentioned peers, friends, et cetera. And not to say that I don't think that it's, you know, I don't think it's all hooey necessarily. It could be true. What you helped me kind of realize on that is there's a certain level of outer truth that is near impossible to determine where the truth lies and where the truth ends. And as I've learned, well, and even in studying and preparing for this, you know, and we talk about the inner game a lot, you know, applying that judgment of what is truth and what is not truth is a judgment. And applying that judgment and only seeking what is verifiable truth is a bit of a holy grail quest, right? Can't be done on a pure level. And so you're going to have to deal with ambiguity. You're going to have to continue to think about things critically, and you're going to have to accept that you'll never know the absolute truth of anything. And I think in a spiritual sense, that's part of life. That's why we're here.
Oh, very nice. Yes. Yeah. One of the things leveled against conspiracy theorists, of course, quite ironically, is that they're trying to make sense. They're looking for an easy explanation to try and make sense of a world that doesn't seem to make any sense. But I think the opposite. Any conspiracy researcher worth their salt is on an ongoing quest, as you said, and that could be outer truth or inner truth. So, Yeah, with the Outer Truth stuff, really what you were describing that happened to you at the pandemic, of course, we can use the Matrix language and say you took the red pill. Or, you know, maybe you took the red pill by mistake. I don't know. But
no, exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah, there is this ignorance is bliss thing that still goes on. And now, of course, this is ground we've covered a lot on Life and Life Only about picking media sources and picking how many media sources you consume, which and how many and how much you believe them. That's the thing. I mean, these are fundamental questions. Regarding goals, I'll just direct the listeners back to the... God, how many hours was that thing I did on Derren Brown and happiness? however many hours it was, we talked about goals, and Derren's not a big fan. For me, I think it depends on the person. Same way that with life coaching, one thing I do remember saying when I did the podcast about it, some people are very, very practical, and they are people who are not really looking for anything emotional. And then other people are looking for something more emotional, and then some people are in the middle. Similarly, goals will work for some people and won't work for others. But it's all about knowing yourself and trying things and seeing what works for you, rather than saying, well, this guru told me that goals are a good thing, or this guru told me that they aren't, you know? It's trial and error. I like the thing that you said about your daughter, because, you know, there's that old joke that therapists, again, I'm not saying I'm a therapist, but therapists are the craziest people around. And there is some truth to that, in that often something you impart to another person might not be something that you necessarily do yourself. I think society in general in the past would just say, well, you're a hypocrite. You know, you're telling this guy not to procrastinate and you're procrastinating yourself. You're a hypocrite. But I think we've moved on from that to say, well, sometimes you can know something is the right thing, but it's a challenge that you can't necessarily overcome. But the thing with your daughter, maybe what will come out of our sessions is that you help your daughter not to procrastinate. And again, I think concrete goals are fine, tangible goals are fine, and we should, if it works for you, you should go for those. But the other thing is that inadvertent advantages of things. So really, it's just being completely open, I think.
That's just it, right? That's what I, you know, this, the Outer Truth journey has led me to, that it doesn't have to be quantifiable. I don't need to know the absolute truth. I can't know the absolute truth. If I accept that, then what do I strive for? Well, you know, it's inherent things that feel inherently good. And one of them is human connection, particularly with my family. And so, you know, this conversation about procrastination opened a door with my daughter to have a real conversation, which felt great. I didn't solve her problem. Hopefully I helped, you know, via you agreed that you gave me the tools to make a new or a deeper human connection than I already had, right? And those are the things that feel good, right? Those are the things that feel like progression. It's not by studying and learning, you know, alternative systems that I am gaining happiness or peace, right? It's through others.
Yeah, I don't think the red pill is going to make anyone happier necessarily. I think
That's just it. You're waiting for something new once you dive too far into that, right? But how do you solve it all? Is where I got to. Well, if this is the truth, then how is it going to get solved? It's a mess. Let's solve it. And you can't, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all I'd say really is that if we take an example of someone in the alt media movement that I think is a legend, that's James Corbett, and he does listen to this, and you mentioned him earlier. What's very interesting is that when I first got into alternative media, which was around the time that he started, 2007, 8, around then, I realized after about a year or so that in a way I'd kind of been brainwashed the other way. And I'm not saying by James, it would be more by someone like Alex Jones. And Alex Jones was actually fairly credible in about 2008. He's changed massively and become this total cartoon character now, really. And what was I going to say? Yeah, I realized after a while that all that's really happened is I've just been brainwashed by the alternative rather than the mainstream. And now I'm not believing anything mainstream anymore. But what you'll find if you listen to Corbett Report and other ones, he's actually using mainstream media sources a lot of the time. And I kind of confirmed this, I think, when James, when he was on. I can't remember if it was on mic or off mic. And I said, I've realized that you're using mainstream. The mainstream media are actually telling you the truth. It's just buried on page 36 or
Yeah.
You know, and it's downplayed while they're hitting you with all this crap that either is not true or you don't need to know. You know, celebrities, for example. So I guess, I can't even remember what the point I was coming to, but yeah, I guess just in the outer truth.
It's about thinking critically, though, if I could pick up the thought, right? That's the exercise. Agreed. It's not that one side is good and one side is bad. That's into the judgment again, right? Mm. It's all information, and you have to decide what to decide your actions based on that, right? So what do you believe? What resonates with you? What feels right, I guess, is really what it comes down to. If you can't, I don't have the resources or the time of James Corbett to do the impeccable research that he does do. So I won't be on that level that he's at. I won't have the energy he's got towards it. But it does open my eyes, and it does help me on a different, on a path to think more critically about the world in itself. And he says that in every show, right? You know, here's all the info. The links are in the show notes. Go find out for yourself, right?
Yeah. I think I know why I mentioned mainstream media now. I was saying that, yeah, we don't know what the truth is, but I think actually when the mainstream media reveals something, it probably is the truth. When they reveal something that they don't highlight, when they bury it on page, you know, I guess, I don't even know if people read newspapers anymore, but metaphorically in small print on page 48 of the newspaper, that's probably true. So you could probably can gauge stuff that is true from what they're actually revealing while they're, you know, doing the magician's trick of putting your attention over here. I think they bank on enough of the public being undiscerning in the way they consume news that they can sort of reveal the truth to you, you know? Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, we're a different conversation, I think.
yeah. I was going to say, do you mind if we move on to the tennis stuff? Because we have got so much to cover. Okay, so let's move on to what will probably be the main bulk of our talk here. So this is The Inner Game of Tennis. So this is a book written in, published in 1974 by W. Timothy Galway. He's subsequently done other ones on golf, The Inner Game of Golf, The Inner Game of Music, The Inner Game of Work. I don't know how that would work, but wouldn't that depend on what work you were doing? But anyway, this book, just in case someone's listening who's not really into tennis, I think I said at the top of the show that it's not, that there is tennis stuff in it, but what I would like to focus on, if you don't mind, is maybe the stuff that's not about how to serve better or how to hit a better forehand. That's used very cleverly as a metaphor for wider skills, both in sport and in life, maybe.
Right. Yeah, that's the genius of this book, I think. You know, as a fairly amateur club tennis player, and for you, a better table tennis player, the parallels or the mental side of it resonates with us because we've done these things, I guess. Mm. But it very quickly turns to a lesson on life, and we've already referenced it a couple times, right? But as we get into it, that's the genius of the book, I think, is the metaphor for life.
Absolutely. And you can imagine this often happens with books. It happened with, you know, The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle.
Yeah.
You suddenly see loads of books come on the market like More Power of Now or, you know, The Power of Now Revisited or whatever these titles are. Obviously, the publisher said to them, can you now write a load of other books which are pretty much similar but change them a little bit? So I don't blame Mr. Galway for the fact that, you know, I haven't read his books on golf and music and stuff. I don't blame him at all. But I think sometimes in a way, if you write a book that's too good, like The Power of Now, there's not really too much more to say. So
which one came out first for Mr. Galway? Do you know?
That's a good question, actually. Oh, should we look that up? Yeah, why not? I think it might have been this one, actually.
In my book, it's got a list.
What's the first one?
It's Tennis.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the first one. I don't know I'm sure he'd written other stuff before, but I think in the Inner Game series, this may have been the first one. I think it's definitely the most famous. Perhaps, I mean, there are a lot of golfers in the world, so maybe the golf one. But I guess I was drawn to this one because I was a tennis player and I'm a table tennis player. Yeah, it looks like this was the first one, in fact.
Yeah,
he's got inner skiing, inner golf, inner music, inner work, the inner game of stress. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
One thing I will say now, we'll get onto this later when we talk about the pro tennis, but since we're recording this at the end of February, the Australian Open happened in January, and I've got to tell you, after watching those guys for a few days, you know, the latter stages of it, my table tennis got so much better mentally, because I was just channeling those guys, and I was thinking, you know, if Djokovic and Sinner and Medvedev, you know, if they can push themselves to the brink for 5 hours, you know, should be able to last a table tennis match, for God's sake. So this is what you're saying about we can apply it to things other than tennis, but we can apply what the pros say to our league matches, our local league matches, you know?
That's just it, right? And I think that separates, you know, the truly great athletes from the regular athletes is what's going on between their ears, right? In their head.
Yeah.
Right. You know, the Roger Federer's, the Nadal's, the Djokovic's, you know, the mental toughness that's there is clearly different than some others, right? And it comes out in results. Tiger Woods, I think, is a good example, right, of a single-minded focus on winning golf tournaments for all those years.
Absolutely,
And the results speak for themselves, right?
Yeah, I think one thing I worked out a few years ago, and this was through listening to podcasts about tennis. There's one I listened to because it's called The Tennis Podcast. They were talking about, they were, I think it was the French or Wimbledon last year, and they were watching a guy practicing who's about 150 in the world. I can't even remember his name. And they said, we were watching this guy and he just looked like the best player in the world. Like they just couldn't believe the shots he was playing. But what you realize is that I don't think there's a huge difference between the shots that Djokovic plays and the shots that the number 80 in the world plays. It's just how well you can play them consistently and under pressure and how you can learn how to play the same shots. I'm sure if you just had guys with no pressure, most of them could probably play roughly the same shot, right? Would you agree with that?
I think that's it, right?
I think so.
It's all about the moment, doing it in the moment under those lights in that situation, right?
Absolutely.
All of the pros, if you spend all your life doing something, you're going to be pretty good at it. Hmm. And you can do it when no one's watching. You have done it when no one's watching for the 10,000 hours, whoever, you know, becoming the expert. But to be able to do it with the lights on center court Wimbledon after 5 hours of doing it already, right? That's the separator. Who's got it still at that point?
Absolutely. And sometimes you maintain your level and sometimes you even get better while others get worse. Right. We'll talk about nerves later, which is more the side of, you know, some people just fall apart in that situation. But I mean, I've always been lucky. I'm honestly not bigging myself up. I will tell you all day my faults and my deficiencies. But one thing I had on my side, because I used to play table tennis tournaments as a junior, I was kind of county level as a junior, I always was able to stay calm. And in those days, you know, I didn't know anything about meditation. I didn't do anything. It's just luck, because other people I know, they fall apart or they just can't maintain their game. And they, you know, they could read 100 of these books and probably help, but it's not going to fix it. And now when I play, I occasionally play in the league with a guy. I don't think he's into psychology necessarily, but he's into the mental side of sport. And he says, I get in this mindset where I just think I can't lose. And that doesn't mean you take the foot off the gas. This is it's a very subtle distinction. But if you go into a thing saying, I can't lose, it doesn't mean that literally you can't lose. But you just have this thing where when the pressure comes, even if it's just local league, whatever it is, there is still pressure, you know, even if you've just got five people watching you. There's just a thing where I'm either going to maintain my level or I'm going to get better and I'm actually going to enjoy it. And you see, me being a performer, because I was a musician, I have the performance thing of being, I'm a kind of a understated show-off. You know, I didn't used to go on stage in like in ridiculous outfits and start leaping about. I didn't really do anything on stage. I like talking to the audience. But I have a thing where if 10 people are watching me, I generally get better. And it's part of being a performer. It's part of, some childish need for attention. I don't know what it is, but I don't analyze it too much. But
it gives you a sharpness, though, right? It brings you up rather than brings you down. And I suppose there's some people that would crumble under that pressure a little bit, right?
Yeah. I think people either crumble, they either more or less stay the same, or they get better. And if you're lucky, you get better. But if you're fairly lucky, you don't lose your level.
Yeah. But it's a skill, though. That's the point, I think, going back to the pros. It's a skill that can be refined. I think you've seen it in your life.
Yes.
You've seen it in mine, that it grows. The more you do it, the better you become at it.
Hmm.
And it's part of, you know, for the Djokovic's of the world, you know, or the, you know, the end of the five-setter for Sinner and Medvedev.
Hmm.
You know, who can hold it the longest? Who's still focused on the game and nothing else?
Yeah.
Every shot, right? Like the 5 hour. That to me is why tennis is one of the purely mental sports. Is after 5 hours of intense physical competition, to still have the mental focus to make delicate shots is difficult, right?
Oh my God, yeah. I've compared it to boxing quite a bit. Because it's almost the same, except you're not hitting the person directly. You're bludgeoning them via a tennis ball, you know. But it's pretty similar. I mean, obviously boxing is a lot harder in the sense that someone is literally whacking you in the head. I mean, you could die in a boxing match. Thankfully, the stats for boxing deaths are incredibly small. But you know, it could happen. And in fact, at the U.S. Open last year, September. Do you remember it was incredibly hot? Medvedev was actually quoted as saying, someone's going to die out here. You know, I don't think he meant it literally, but when he played, I think it was Rublev.
Yeah.
He was like, someone's going to die, man. You know, this is not good. You know, you've got to do something about this. But yeah, I'm sure we'll get back to that as in the course of this conversation. Let's talk about self-one and self-two. Can you tell the listeners what that means?
Yeah. Mm. And I think this is one of the really... one of the big points of this book. So the self-one is what Timothy Galloway describes as your ego mind. And self-two is your physical body, I guess, or the act of performing these actions. So self-one is kind of like, I think of it as, well, as a parent. I think of it as self-one is the parent and self-two is the child.
Mm.
And self-one is trying to direct the child's behavior in an overbearing kind of way. It's driven by results. He's driven by self. One is driven by results, by judgment, by labeling. Whereas self two, on the other hand, is the natural flow of performing the action. So when you know, to use the tennis example, you know, someone who's practiced tennis for their entire lives and is able to do these shots in their sleep, so to speak, it is that act of doing it. That's self two performing. Whereas self-one is the one trying to label, oh, that was a good forehand, that was a bad forehand, your unit turn was slow, you didn't drop your racket, follow through over your shoulder. All of those kinds of technical things are the self-one being judgmental to the self-two.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think you said about parent-child, that's perfect, really. I think I got this from the book. Yeah, self-one is the teller and self-two is the doer. And I've just written, when we beat ourselves up, it's when we, you know, when people talk to themselves, and I play against table tennis players, and as soon as they start talking to themselves, I almost know I've won, because they, well, when they talk, if they were saying, oh, come on, you know, like in an encouraging way, but people will often say, ah, oh, what was that, after they played a bad shot, and you almost know you're going to win. I guess McEnroe would be a bit of an exception there, McEnroe back in the day. But yes, so when you see people talking to themselves and criticizing themselves, it's self-one criticizing self-two. It's the pushy parent not trusting their child. And the thing he says in the book is, if your child was learning to walk by crawling, you don't start have a go at them and say, oh, that was a terrible crawl. What are you doing? You know, you just let it develop. And this is what he says in the book. You know, we're not, if you treated other people the way you treat yourself a lot of the time, this applies to everybody. You'd be horrified the way we talk to ourselves, how judgmental we are about ourselves. So what he's saying in the book is that we're all a bit like two selves. We have our ego, and then we all have, when we can leave our ego at the door, you know, that's when we feel good, you know. And that's why, just going back to the life coaching, I feel like what we established between us was, I wouldn't say egoless, because everybody's got an ego, okay, but it's a thing where you're trying to let your ego go. And just let things happen naturally. And I think I had another note. I can't remember if it's on this document here, but it's actually easier to do things better and more naturally. It's more effort to create a load of stress and to put barriers in your way. And the only reason I can think that people do it, it's all to do with fear, really.
It's how we've been taught, though, right? We've been taught to label actions good and bad. It's you know, the premise of the school system to grade and judge. You know, it's the premise of most religion to label good and bad. It becomes human nature to think that way, right? Which is, to me, the real breakthrough when you start to think through the self one and self two, that if the more that you can, you know, play tennis or live life in the self two mindset rather than and ignore the self one mindset, the more success that you'll have. And it's very, very clear and easily to test, well, on a tennis court anyways, if you play tennis, to try to control those thoughts in the match. You know, the very moment you start thinking about technique in the middle of a shot or in the middle of a sequence or a rally, it almost certainly will end badly for you, right? Timothy Galway talks about in the book, when a player is playing in flow, they are playing out of their mind or unconscious in the zone. And it's all referencing this being out of their mind, being out of the self two mind, a self one mindset. You're in the self two mindset. You're doing, not thinking.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I haven't read that book that's actually called Flow. I'd quite like to, actually, but I listen to a lot of podcasts where they review books. And sometimes, I'll be honest, I use it as a shortcut to reading the book because I listen to, you know, sometimes they're like 2 hours or something and they really go hard on it. But yeah, that flow thing is just fantastic. And, you know, people get it when they run. You know, you get it through sex. You get it through, I mean, I get it, to be honest, when I'm working, because I work in retail, one of my jobs anyway. And when I'm in the flow of serving customers, I get in the flow state. And I love it, and there's a rhythm to it. And being a musician, I'm all for rhythm. So that flow state is fantastic. And it's not that you can manufacture it, but if you could just stop the mind, I mean, if we could just stop our damn minds from just, as you said, judging and just stop thinking. We'll get onto meditation later, because obviously I'll just refer back later to it. Obviously did a two-parter on meditation, and that's such a big part of it. Does he actually mention the word meditation in the book? I feel like he doesn't, does he?
I don't think he does.
No, but it's clearly what he's talking about. It's exactly the same thing, yeah.
Yeah, thoughts lead to actions. And so the more practice you have controlling your thoughts, your mind, and if you're, you know, if you're adept at controlling your thoughts, then you will be adept at living in the flow state or in the self-two mode, if you will, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you could do it all day, really, can't you? That's another thing that in meditation books they say you can go about your entire day meditatively. There you go. Can't say the word, but I know what it means. You don't have to be in the lotus position and you don't have to be in a competitive situation. There's a way of living your life, and you're still paying attention to all the things you need to pay attention to. But another thing, I don't know if you ever find this with tennis. Do you ever play against someone who seems to just have about 1 second more than everyone else to play his shot?
Yeah.
You know, Medvedev's a bit like that, isn't he? He plays the shot about half a second later than you expect him to.
Yeah.
And that's a great metaphor, because you can go about your day just doing everything just a tiny bit slower, and you don't lose any time at all. That's another myth, that doing things in a hurry, you save a lot of time. You don't really. You save seconds or maybe minutes.
Yeah, it's efficiency though, right? Like the really active tennis players that are agile, the most agile, they just move fluidly. They get places to the ball quicker, and it gives them that extra. It makes it look easy, right?
Mm. Yeah, I kind of try and cultivate this during my day. When somebody asks me something or I'm having a conversation, not a podcast, not a recorded one like this, but just a normal conversation, what I've started to do is just take a couple of seconds before I answer. Because if you watch, when most people are having a conversation, they're answering very, very quickly. And there's a kind of, I suppose it's a kind of flow, but it's more a kind of, everybody's just in a hurry, you know, particularly in cities, and you know how it is. People are just doing everything in a hurry.
So there's a pressure to answer quickly, or you know, whether or not it's well thought out or not, right?
Yeah, it's a sort of pace that we seem to all need to live our lives at, and we all kind of feed off each other in a way. So when you when you find someone who's doing everything a bit slower, they seem like some sort of weirdo, like, you know, come on, you know. So if you're an employee or something, your boss might be saying, oh, where's that urgency? But you can get a lot done by not having that urgency. But just, as you said, focusing and getting the job done, focusing fully on the task. But you don't have to do that in a hurry. Okay, so just reading from the document here. So I've got, again, I honestly can't remember which of these are quotes from the book and which is stuff I've written, but it doesn't matter. My own worst enemy, I usually beat myself. Is it better to emote or stay silent? Yeah, let me ask you about that, because obviously the great thing about Borg and McEnroe back in the day was that Borg would not say a word, you know, during the in the match, and McEnroe would emote. So how do you feel, like, personally about emoting and staying silent? How would it work for you if you're playing a tennis match, say?
I think it's the way that you just described it just a few minutes ago is excellent, right? As soon as you start criticizing yourself, I think the emotion is fine, but it's the self-criticism that has the negative connotation. You see it a lot in tennis, though, because, you know, it's a game of margins and you're physically engaged, that it's easy to have an emotional outburst, right? There are lots of clips of racket smashing or throwing or, you know, stories of errant balls being hit in anger, right? So I don't think that the emotion is necessarily bad. It's the self-criticism that's bad. The book talks about, you know, how do you get to this? How do you increase your chances of living in the self-to mode? Well, it's by putting aside all judgment. There's no such thing as good shots or bad shots. Yes, shots will be in or shots will be out or shots will be winners or not. But there's no labeling. If there is no labeling, then it's just a shot. And the more that you can live without the judgment or play without the judgment, you will create a detachment from the results, and the results will come.
Yeah, and of course, if we were to sort of widen this out, we're making a presumption that tennis players all want to be world number one. I don't know if you and I have ever talked about this. But if you take Kyrgios, who, by the way, was just fantastic as a commentator in the Australian Open, just brilliant, because he's the man on the street. He's saying stuff that we're thinking rather than all this, you know, having to hold back all the time. He said, you know, everyone tells me I should be world number one with the talent I've got, or should be winning slams. And I think he does want to win slams, but he says, you know, I'm actually having a great life. Do I want to torture myself? So if we widen out this judgment thing, okay, you know, most people, when you play a match, you'd probably like to win rather than lose. But maybe, you know, if you're having a good time and you play a few shots and you, you know, you learn something about your game, maybe a lost match could be better than a won match. I think we could widen this talk out as far as we wanted to. But like I said, we'll be here forever if we do that. But no, I mean, there's just so much scope, isn't there?
I mean, I think, you know, in Kyrgios' case, anyways, if I could judge him from the outside, right? Like, he obviously has the skill level, and he obviously hears that to say that. You know, maybe it's hard to say. What do you think he believes he's got when people tell him that? Do you think he believes it, that he could and should be number one, could and should be winning slams? I agree he wants to. I hard to say whether or not he wants to be number one. But if you flip that on the head, right, who's the 800th tennis player in the world who has less of a chance of being number one than Kyrgios does? You know, why do they play the game? What gets them up in the morning, right?
Well, I guess if it's your job, if you manage to, I don't know if the 800 in the world is a pro, I suppose you can make it as a pro tennis player with that ranking. I guess you can. But let's say, you know, we're 200 in the world, whatever it is. I guess if it's their job, it's what they do, so that would motivate.
And there'll be a range of people, right? Some that are on the upward trajectory, some that are holding on, some that just want to, or that are treating it like a job, I suppose, and a means to an end, and some that are, you know, on the decline, right, and on their way out.
Yeah, absolutely. With Kyrgios, I think I'll just slightly temper what I said earlier. I don't know if maybe they didn't say he should be number one, but I think they said he should have won some slams. Yeah, I think that's the point. Yeah. So, I think he absolutely wants to win some slams. And there was a funny moment in the Australian Open he interviewed Sinner after he'd won, and he said something like, oh, how much would you charge to be my coach so I can win some slams? So he obviously does want to win, but I just think we make a presumption that everyone wants to kill themselves to be world number one. Because I think, as I said, we both play racket sports, locally at least, and I think I can't really understand what it takes to be Novak Djokovic or even Jannik Sinner. And I've got some idea of it, but I don't think the average person would have any idea about the sacrifices. And all they see is that they have a great life and it's so glamorous and they get $3 million or whatever it is. You know, it's a bit like with any famous people. I don't think most of them are having a great time. And I think with tennis, it's terribly unforgiving because you're just away from your family all the time unless you bring them with you. So all I'm saying, really, I can understand how Kyrgios would want to have a great life. And you could see parties a lot. He's probably, I was trying to think of their word, tomcatting. You know that, you know, with some of the ladies and whatever it is, you know. So he's probably having a great time.
To put it in perspective, though, right, Aaron, you've played enough table tennis or gotten to a high enough level to know what it takes to, say, be the best player in the county, right, or in the club. And it's not to say you couldn't do that, but are you willing to make the sacrifices that would be required to play that much table tennis in order to get to that level, right? And if, you know, you're pursuing other things in your life that give you satisfaction instead, and, you know, while doing that as a hobby, drawing the amount of satisfaction that you need.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the balance of our lives, anyways, regular guys who have day jobs as well as hobbies, right?
Yeah.
It's a sacrifice you and I aren't willing to make. And I mean, I guess on some level, I guess it's a sacrifice Kyrgios himself is not willing to make. Right? He could do it. He's closer than you or I.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I play in this local league, and I've just come back, actually, after... I've always played table tennis, but I've sort of come back to playing seriously in the last couple of years. And I'm in Division 2 of my local league, but I've been playing in Division 1 as a reserve. And funnily enough, next week I'm actually playing... I volunteered to play the best guy in the town because I just want to see how far behind him I am. But I'm going to enjoy it because I'm just going to let my shots go and I'm not expecting to win. And I'm not even thinking about whether I'm going to win or not. I'm just going to play my shots and have a good time. But I'm curious to see how far behind this guy I am. Is he going to just wipe me off the court? Is he just going to be just good enough on the big points? Obviously, my local level of table tennis is nothing like Grand Slam tennis, but it is a similar thing in that there is a way where I could probably play 5 days a week. And I could say, well, next year, I'm going to try and get in the top 10 in my local area. But honestly, I can't be bothered. I'm too busy doing other stuff, and I don't care about it that much. But I think I've got a nice detachment from it. So, yeah, I'm just saying, really, we're using Kyrgios as an example. I kind of understand it, and I understand what kind of person he is. He's a kind of guy who wants to have a lot of fun, I think. He probably doesn't have the attention span of a Federer who... Federer's having a nice life, obviously, but it's more of a monastic life than Kyrgios. You know, I mean, Kyrgios was on Instagram with Andy Murray. He really likes Andy Murray for some reason. You wouldn't think that they would have gelled, but he did an Instagram with Andy Murray during coronavirus, and he's chugging, you know, red wine, and he's clearly drunk, and he's in a nice way. He's a happy drunk, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, we should caveat that we don't know the guy. We know we're judging him immensely.
Yeah, but I do love his media stuff. I think he was brilliant. Yeah. He was such a breath of fresh air at the Australian Open.
And again, nothing against him, but from the outer truth side of things, that's the image he wants you to see. He or his people or his the Kyrgios machine. It's a business, right? It's well crafted. It's not something. There is a level of organic to it, but I don't think it's the true Kyrgios, right? It's a character on some level.
Yeah, it's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, he I think you can probably only fake it to a certain extent, but whenever I have friends and we're talking and they've met someone famous, I'm always quite curious, even though I think fame is a fairly ridiculous phenomenon, I'm always quite curious to say, were they like their public image? And just to give you just a totally random example, I had an American friend who used to, she worked in New York, and she was kind of on the fringes of the entertainment industry. And she was just name checking a few people she'd met, and she'd met Grace Jones. And we all know what Grace Jones's image is. And she said Grace Jones was such a sweetheart. Like, I'm sure Grace Jones was a total diva in other certain circumstances, but yeah, I don't know. It's difficult to say, isn't it? He seems like an authentic kind of guy, and I think he probably prides himself on, I don't know, running off at the mouth almost, or telling the truth.
Mm. Agreed.
Okay, let's just move on. I'm just going to read a little bit from the book. This is a very, very short. I don't want to bore you and the listeners with long passages, but this chapter has got a little bit about Zen and archery, because I think I've never done archery, but there is a book called Zen in the Art of Archery. And you can see how archery would work perfectly with the idea of Zen and concentration, because you've got to be perfectly still to release the arrow. So I'll just read a little bit. As soon as we reflect, deliberate, and conceptualize, the original unconsciousness is lost and a thought interferes. The arrow is off the string but does not fly straight to the target, nor does the target stand where it is. Calculation, which is miscalculation, sets in. Man is a thinking reed, but his great works are done when he is not calculating and thinking. Childlikeness, don't know if that's a word, has to be restored with long years of training in self-forgetfulness. Which is kind of inner and outer truth. There's a lot of trying to forget things that you've been taught, isn't there?
Yeah, I don't know if it's forgetting necessarily, but it's focusing on something different. It's to pull in the meditation, it's living in the here and now, right? When you're playing tennis, doing archery, playing table tennis, the more that you can focus on what is happening right in this very moment and not, not even 10 seconds from now, which is the heart of meditation, right? When you sit down to meditate and do your breathing exercises, the idea is to clear your mind as clear as possible. Mm-hmm. And one way to do that, or the technique I learned via you and a few other resources, is to focus on your breathing, right? And focus on the breath going in and the breath going out. And the more that you can focus on that, that's the only thing that's happening while you're sitting in a chair or on the floor meditating comfortably, right? That's all that's happening. And yeah, that's all you're thinking about.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things about meditation is that some books I've read, they say that actually being totally still doesn't always work for people, and that you can actually be meditative while doing an activity. And I kind of said for a joke, I'd like to write a book called Zen and the Art of Washing Up, as in washing the dishes, because something that changed my life, I did a meditation class, and the teacher was giving some examples of stuff you can do meditatively, and he said washing up. You know, because if you use a washing up bowl, you've got nice warm water. You put your hands in the warm water and you craft the washing of the plates as if you were crafting some, as if you're sculpting some masterpiece. And it's actually incredibly pleasurable.
It's funny you were saying that. I've kind of recognized this here recently as well. Or I read a book, or I listened to a podcast about a book called Atomic Habits. If you haven't read it, it's very good. But it talks about doing the little things which turn into big things. I won't go too far into it, but doing the dishes is one of the things that it talks about. And I've been trying to, and this is kind of a tactic for procrastination as well, but doing things like making your bed every morning, putting your coat in the closet as soon as you walk in the door, doing dishes the very moment they need to be done, not procrastinating these little things starts to build a foundation towards not procrastinating the bigger things. But in any case, the moments you take to do these things is very short, right? The dishes is a good example, because it takes a little longer to do dishes than it does to hang a coat up. But if you take the time to do that, you're doing nothing else, right? You're thinking only of how do I get this dish clean to the clean standard that you need it or want it. And in doing so, you get into a dishwashing flow, right? A self-tube dishwashing state, which later on when you come back and the dishes are clean and not, you don't have a sink full of dishes, it's a great feeling, right?
Yeah, it is. And just the act of doing it, especially, in the winter when you put your hands in that warm water. Oh, it feels nice.
It's a different mindset. You have to think about it as something that has to be done. It's a thing that you get to do, right? Enjoy the journey.
Yeah, enjoy the journey of the dishes, absolutely. Yeah, completely. It's interesting you mentioned about, did you say about making your bed? Yeah, I read that in a book. I haven't read that Atomic Habits, but again, I've probably listened to podcasts about it. Yeah, there is a thing they said about if you rush out of your bed and you don't put the duvet back straight, it's not going to shatter your day or anything. But I find in some weird way, if I take the time to do that, I somehow feel a bit better. It's I think this book explained it much better than I did. But
there's something about getting into a made bed, right? Getting into a made bed is a lot nicer than getting into an unmade bed.
Yes.
And there is something small and subtle that changes when you make your bed before you leave the house. You can't describe it, but it's like a stepping stone to something else. And anyways, I've started using hanging up my coat. I used to throw it on the banister, right? Or a little knob at the end of the stairs at our house. And we'd all throw our coats there. And then it turns into, sometimes we each have two or three coats on this knob, right? It's kind of ridiculous. But it takes 30 seconds to walk to the front closet and put it in there. And now there's no coats on, or at least none of my coats, on the banister anymore. It's a great feeling, right?
Yeah, it's just a small, And what we're really saying is these small little things can kind of add up. Just taking your time doing things. Just doing something, because I think we all have a very, very skewed idea of time. Because I remember that someone was saying, they did some experiment where there was a person who was, when they were late for work, they would run to work. And there is a benefit to that, actually, running for the bus. It's what's called low-level stress. It gets your body going. There's benefits to it. But if it comes with a stressful feeling, they actually worked out that if this person ran their route instead of walking it, it was something like they saved about 90 seconds. It was something ridiculous. The actual amount of time you save by doing things in a hurry is incredibly small. Even over the course of a day, it's probably seconds or minutes. Obviously, if you're sprinting, it's a bit different. But doing things in a stressed, hurried way, you're barely saving yourself any time. And that was a massive thing wherever I read that. Or maybe I figured it out for myself.
End of part one.